The final clinical investigator interviewed for this program is Dr. Robert Mannell, who presented a young woman who was referred after having primary surgery at another hospital.
She's 46 years old, young and healthy. She had a total abdominal hysterectomy and bilateral salpingophorectomy at an outside hospital for a pelvic mass. The final pathology returned consistent with a grade 3 serous adenocarcinoma of the ovary. And when talking to the referring surgeon, he reported no evidence of disease outside the left ovary by visual exam at the time of surgery. Patient had really no other staging procedure type done, and her postoperative course was uncomplicated. She had no other medical issues, and then was seen in my office 2 weeks post-op for a consultation.
What were some of the questions that kind of came up to you as you sort of looked through this case?
Well, I think one of the things that we would do as a gynecologic oncologist is to step back and ask the question, has the patient been adequately staged? Because as with cancer treatment anywhere in the body, your treatment is going to be based upon an adequate knowledge and an accurate knowledge of what the stage of the disease is. And we know with these cancers that are high grade and appear to be limited to one ovary, that in actuality, a fairly high percentage of them will have metastatic disease on re-exploration. All the way back in 1980s, Young reported on results from the National Cancer Institute and his ovarian cancer referral network that about 30% of patients who were referred to them with what was presumed to be stage 1 disease or disease limited to the ovary actually had metastatic disease at time of follow-up workup. And that's been confirmed by multiple other trials since that time.
Now, do you think there's anything different that the original surgeon could have done? Should they have closed the abdomen? Or is there something along the process that could have been done differently?
I think that when dealing with a pelvic mass, I think the most important thing is initially to try to determine what the likelihood of it being malignant is. And so do we need to get a preoperative CA-125? What are the characteristics of the ultrasound or the CT scan? And if there is evidence that is concerning for a malignancy, then that patient probably is best served by referral to a surgeon who's skilled in the surgical management and staging for ovarian cancer. If it was, as in the case of this one, where the CA-125 was in the normal range and there was no evidence of ascites or metastatic disease and the cyst was kind of borderline, a lot of times those are the kind of the unexpected cancers that show up. And at that time, the question is, does that surgeon have the skill set to do the staging or not? Now, staging, if you look at these cancers, interestingly, a lot of times people think the most likely place for these early ovarian cancers to be would be in the abdominal cavity. And yes, that does happen about 5 to 10% of the time. However, the most common place for occult metastatic disease is actually in the periaortic lymph nodes, and that happens about 20% of the time. So a full staging on this patient would be not just assessment of the abdominal cavity with multiple intraperitoneal biopsies, diaphragm assessment, and infracolic omentectomy, but also a full pelvic and periaortic lymph node sampling as well.
And based on what you might find doing that kind of staging, how would that affect what you'd be doing at that point?
Right. So the question then becomes, how does an appropriate stage impact your management? In this country, and once again, Europe's a little bit different, but in this country, if a patient has a stage 1A grade 1 disease and has negative staging, then those patients can be managed conservatively and would not require any further therapy. They would not be candidates for chemotherapy. If they have stage 1B or 1C grade 2 or 3 disease, or if they have stage 2 disease of any type, then they would be a candidate for more treatment.
How much variability is there in pathologists actually doing the grading?
I think that it's difficult to do a 3-tier grading system, and we're kind of morphing into more of a low-grade, high-grade system. And for all intents and purposes, grade 2s and 3s are treated more along a high grade, and grade 1s are considered low grade.
In this situation, so you were considering whether or not to surgically stage her at that point?
That's correct. And so one of the hesitancies in the past has been, well, gosh, this patient has just undergone a major exploratory laparotomy. Am I going to be setting this particular individual back by doing a repeat surgery? The way I like to counsel my patients is a couple of things. Number one is there's a possibility we may find grossly visible disease in the abdomen. A lot of times these surgeries are done by, once again, a surgeon who's not skilled in cancer surgery or maybe using a low transverse or fan and steel incision and doesn't have adequate exposure to the entire abdomen. And a lot of places for occult metastatic disease aren't necessarily places which you would easily see, such as the periaortic lymph nodes or the diaphragmatic surface. So having said that, I think that there's a possibility in this particular patient that she may have actually macroscopic disease. And so the surgery is the first to determine is there any macroscopic disease, because if there is, then that patient would definitely benefit from aggressive debulking surgery to remove any macroscopic disease. In the absence of macroscopic disease, then a staging for microscopic disease can be carried out. Now, at our institution, we do a lot of this laparoscopically now or with minimally invasive technique. So for this particular patient, we would start off with a laparoscopic approach. With laparoscopy, we would assess the entire abdominal cavity. And if we see no evidence of gross metastatic disease, we would do her full staging laparoscopically.
If you did see something macroscopically, she'd have to have an open procedure?
That's correct. Well, in our hands, yes, there are some people that will do more extensive debulking surgery with hand-assisted laparoscopy. I think that that's probably not too common, however, and most people would probably convert to an open procedure at that point.
So what actually happened with this patient?
This patient, we did have laparoscopic staging, and at the time of surgery, there was no gross disease seen anywhere. However, on microscopic pathology, she had a microscopic implant on her diaphragm, and one of her periaortic lymph nodes was positive as well.
So when you assessed her postoperatively, what were you thinking? What were you estimating in terms of her chance of developing progressive disease or recurrent disease, and what about adjuvant therapy?
So I think that we could have gone down a couple of different roads. Let's assume that everything had been negative in the surgical staging, and this lady indeed did have a stage 1A grade 3 cancer. We know that those people without further therapy have close to a 50% chance of recurrence, and that with additional treatment that we can reduce that by about half. So with traditional therapy that's out there, platinum-based therapy, these patients have about a 75 to 80% progression-free survival. Having said that, there still is some room for improvement, and several large trials have looked at, should I combine drugs with the platinum agent? How many cycles should I give? I think the two most informative large trials that have looked at that, one comes from the GOG, and one comes from Europe, which is a combination of ACTION and ICON. And the ACTION and ICON trial actually had nearly 900 patients with presumed stage 1 disease. However, a minority of those patients were completely surgically staged. So it made the interpretation a little bit difficult. So it would be taking this patient but not going back and doing a staging surgery. In that particular population, what they did show is patients who received carboplatinum did better than those who were observed. And so it was a phase 3 prospective randomized trial, which indicated that platinum-based therapy was preferable to observation in this population. Once again, the caveat being not all of these patients were completely surgically staged. A small subgroup of this patient population was surgically staged completely, about a fourth of the patients. In that population, interestingly, there was no difference in long-term survival between those that received chemotherapy and those that did not. In other words, patients who were surgically staged to be stage 1 disease, not receiving adjuvant chemo, did just as well as those that had adjuvant chemo. However, more of the patients in that group that did not receive chemotherapy did progress but were salvaged with subsequent treatment. In the United States, we have a little bit different because everybody that's been on the GOG trials have all been surgically staged. So we have a much cleaner population. And in that particular group, what we have shown over time is that chemotherapy is better than nothing. Chemotherapy is better than intraperitoneal P32. And the most recent trial was comparing 3 cycles of carboplatinum Taxol versus 6 cycles of carboplatinum Taxol. That was GOG 157. Now, that trial actually has raised a bit of controversy because if you look at the progression-free survival, it appears to be improved with the 6 cycles of chemotherapy. And a hazard ratio in that particular trial for progression-free was 0.75. However, when you looked at overall survival, the hazard ratio was 1.02. It was completely no difference. The lines are completely superimposable. So the outcome of that particular trial was that 6 cycles resulted in more toxicity. The biggest toxicity was neuropathy. Probably about 11% of the patients had grade 3 or 4 neuropathy versus only about 2% of the patients who received 3 cycles of Taxol carbo. So based upon that, the GOG recommended 3 cycles as being the preferable regimen. There is some controversy, however, with that because of the progression-free survival looking so much superior in the 6-cycle regimen. Ultimately, the Gynecological Cancer Intergroup, the GCIG, which is a worldwide organization, had a consensus conference in 2005. And for them, with adequately staged stage 1 disease patients, their recommendations were treatment with at least 3 cycles of carboplatinum therapy, but they leave open the option for carboplatinum Taxol and up to 6 cycles.
Now, what about this patient specifically?
Well, now she has a whole different category of disease. So she has a stage 3C disease because of her positive lymph nodes, but she has no residual. And that particular patient would be treated in a much more aggressive adjuvant fashion with either intravenous or intraperitoneal chemotherapy for 6 cycles.
What did she end up being treated with?
The patient was counseled, and she was actually treated on a clinical trial that was looking at intraperitoneal chemotherapy. And that particular trial was looking at a modification of the standard intraperitoneal trial in an effort to reduce the toxicity and substituted carboplatinum for the cisplatinum in the intraperitoneal component of the treatment. The trial is being run through the GOG as a phase 1 trial.
What are some of the other research questions that are being asked in these kinds of situations?
So for early stage ovarian cancer, the main research questions are, can we come up with a better way to determine preoperatively if somebody has cancer or not? Because that would avoid this problem altogether if we could. So there are a variety of marker type trials that are being asked, serum marker trials. The GOG is running several of those with some of the new platforms that are out there with microarray and both genomics and proteomic capabilities. There's hope that we can go beyond the standard CA125 and ultrasound matrix, which has a fair degree of predictivity, but it's never going to be 100%, to something that's more precise.
Now, of course, in other tumors, particularly breast cancer, genomic analyses are really having a big impact in how people are being treated. How far along are the studies in ovarian cancer?
Well, I can tell you right now, it's not impacting us clinically. However, from a research standpoint, there's a huge impact. All the major phase 3 trials that are currently being run through the GOG have a heavy translational component, and biomarker analysis is predominant in all of those.
What are some of the clinical trial concepts that are being looked at right now to try to improve the outcome of these people getting adjuvant therapy or intraperitoneal therapy?
So a great example of that is GOG has done a sequence of large phase 3 trials trying to look at intraperitoneal therapy for those patients who have either no residual disease or less than 1 centimeter residual disease after initial debulking surgery. So maybe a little bit different scenario than the first patient I presented, but a quite common scenario, a patient that comes in with obvious ovarian cancer, has a debulking performed, at the completion of that debulking has no residual disease or disease less than 1 centimeter in size. And the question is, what is the standard of care for that patient at this point in time? The standard at this point in time is a combination of platinum and taxane therapy. In this country, that's most commonly carboplatinum at an AUC of 6 and Taxol at 175 milligrams per meter squared every 3 weeks for 6 cycles. That particular regimen has been looked at extensively and is considered the control regimen for most trials. The GCIG, which I mentioned earlier, consensus conference in 2005, stated that in 2005 that should be considered the control arm for ovarian cancer trials. The GOG has looked at intraperitoneal therapy, cisplatinum-based, beginning in the late 1980s and continuing up to the current time. It has published three successive large phase 3 trials, which have shown improvement in progression-free and overall survival using the intraperitoneal approach. The problem with the most recent trial is that there was also increase in toxicity. If you look at improvement in survival, the median improvement in survival in GOG 172 was incredible. It was 17 months. The median survival for the intravenous arm was 49.5 months, and for the intraperitoneal arm was 66.9 months. Now, that's median survival in a disease that 20 years ago had a median survival of 24 months. So this is a huge improvement over our historic controls and an improvement over the addition of taxane, which happened in early 1990s. So it's clear that the intraperitoneal approach will lead to a better survival. The problem is it comes at a cost of toxicity. Now, this particular trial had the most extensive toxicity assessment and quality of life assessment of any trial we've ever done in the GOG. And with that, what we found was this. The major toxicity that seemed to be affecting patients was neurotoxicity. And in the intraperitoneal arm, we had neurotoxicity that was approaching 19%, grade 3 and grade 4. And in the intravenous arm, that was only about 7%. That toxicity persisted up to 1 year after completion of therapy. If you look at overall patient quality of life, all toxicities and all quality of life questions, everything else was the same after 1 year. So it seems that the neurotoxicity is the one that we're struggling with the most. It's also a little bit harder to give intraperitoneal therapy than intravenous. There's a little greater risk of abdominal pain, obviously, some metabolic disturbances, and increased hematogenic potential. But usually with training and with medication, that can be reduced to an acceptable level. This particular patient received the regimen I just mentioned to you, and at the completion of the regimen, she was able to get all six cycles without problem, and at the completion had no evidence of disease, remains disease-free.
And what about in terms of side effects and toxicity?
When we look at the GOG 172 data, only about 42% of the patients were able to complete six cycles of intraperitoneal therapy. What we have noticed in these modified regimens that have been published both from our institution at the University of Oklahoma as well as from other sites such as Memorial and Johns Hopkins, we're getting a much higher completion rate, the GOG as well. And so I think with the modifications that are being made, reducing the dose of the cisplatinum and increasing the antiemetic drugs, that we're seeing better patient tolerance.
And how about this particular patient? How did she tolerate it?
She did well. She completed all six cycles. And at the end of the six cycles, had grade 1 neuropathy, fairly minor. And other than that, had no problems.
Great. Let's talk about your second patient, the 75-year-old woman.
Right. So the 75-year-old woman who underwent a bilateral oophorectomy and omentectomy and debulking. Now, she had pretty extensive disease, which required a sigmoid resection and a low rectal reanastomosis. And she truly had no residual disease at the end of surgery.
How did she present?
She presented in a fairly typical fashion. Ovarian cancer patients, and a lot of research has been done on this, usually will present with some constellation of abdominal symptoms for several months prior to their diagnosis, and she was no different. She had about a six-month history of increasing indigestion, some change in her bowel function, and then about a two-month history of noticing her clothes weren't fitting right, some mid-abdominal girth changes, and that prompted her to go to her physician. Ascites was found and ultimately led to a CT scan, which confirmed the presence of a large left-sided pelvic mass with the ascites, and she was referred to us at that point in time.
What was her general condition, and did she have any significant comorbidities?
No, she was in pretty good shape. Her only comorbidity was some hypertension that was controlled with medication.
What were your thoughts about her post-op?
Right. With our thoughts when we receive a patient like this, the studies are very confirmatory that patients' long-term outcome is based upon, to a large extent, what the surgery allows you to accomplish. And Dennis Chi from Memorial, as well as several others, have reported on the impact of residual disease with outcome. In the consensus of multiple studies, as well as a meta-analysis of the literature, indicates that the smaller residual you get, the better your outcome. And what you really are striving for is no residual disease. That seems to be where the really big break point is. So we strive very hard to get to minimal residual and actually to no residual disease. We were able to accomplish that with this patient. Now, having accomplished that, we know that with appropriately aggressive chemotherapy, her survival is actually quite good. As I mentioned, the median survival in GOG 172 for patients that received intraperitoneal therapy was 67 months. Now, remember, those patients could have up to 1 centimeter residual disease. And as a matter of fact, that trial has now been followed for 9 years, and we still have not reached median survival for ovarian cancer patients stage 3 who were debulked to no residual disease. Now, that's just phenomenal. I mean, we're talking about a disease just a few years ago that nobody would have had a quote like that. So it's clear that we can significantly impact this disease with appropriate management. So in these patients that have no residual disease, we've set them up to be very successful with their chemotherapy. We counsel them regarding intravenous versus intraperitoneal. And at any given point in time, we have a wide range of protocols that are available through the GOG National Cancer Institute. This particular patient participated on a registered trial that was sponsored by Genentech that was looking at Avastin in combination with intraperitoneal therapy. There's not much literature on that, so we have just completed a large phase 1, phase 2 trial looking at the addition of bevacizumab or Avastin to intraperitoneal therapy.
That's interesting. How exactly does the sequence of therapy go then?
So we use the backbone of what was done in GOG 172, and that backbone is cisplatinum intraperitoneally, Taxol intravenously on day 1 and day 2. And then the Avastin is given 15 milligrams per meter squared every 3 weeks on day 1 as well. What's going to happen when I do that? Now, we have not reported our findings yet, but I can tell you that we have not seen any excess toxicity. It appears to be a very doable regimen.
I guess there's a lot of debate, too, about exactly how bevacizumab works, and does it work differently in different tumors? Does it potentiate chemotherapy? I actually interviewed Rakesh Jain, who's done a lot of the basic research for our colon series talking about that. What's your take on that issue?
Well, you know, bevacizumab is a fascinating drug. If you look at our phase 2 trial on bevacizumab for recurrent ovarian cancer, as a single agent, we had absolutely incredible results. That was GOG 170C, and it was presented at the national meetings. And what we have seen is a very robust response. Now, the response rate was 18% and a 6-month progression-free survival rate of almost 40%. And now this isn't a patient population of pre-treated platinum, and half of which were platinum-resistant pre-treated ovarian cancer patients. You would not expect those types of numbers, even with our best cytotoxic agents. So interestingly, in ovarian cancer, in a phase 2 setting, bevacizumab would be considered the most effective agent we've seen. Well, that moved it into our current large phase 3 trial, where it is being in a placebo-controlled trial being used in an upfront setting. How does it work? I think initially people felt we were looking at inhibiting the neovascularization and the blood supply to the tumor. As you allude to, there are some subsequent studies that are looking at, well, is it really doing something as far as changing the permeability of the vessels to inhibit metastatic disease? Is it having some direct impact on the cancer cells themselves, which we didn't initially think that was the case, but perhaps it is? So I think I'm probably, like a lot of researchers out there, just kind of waiting for the answer. I know it works. I'm not sure I can tell you how.
Now, how did this woman do with the treatment?
She did well. This particular trial, likewise, was designed to see if people could receive 6 treatment cycles, because we were concerned about the toxicity of adding Avastin to an intraperitoneal regimen. and she completed all six of her treatment cycles. This particular trial also, interestingly, has a maintenance bevacizumab phase to it, and she is currently receiving her maintenance therapy.
How has she done in terms of toxicity? And particularly, you mentioned she had hypertension. Did that get worse?
So certainly one of the toxicities that we see with Avastin or bevacizumab is hypertension. Usually can be managed by adjustment in their antihypertensive agents. Her particular issue, her urine protein creatinine ratio continued to be normal. It bumped just a little bit, but nothing that was concerning. And her hypertension, she just maintained her current antihypertensives and really didn't need an adjustment.
What about, this woman was 75 years old. I mean, is there an age at which you start backing off from intraperitoneal therapy?
That's a very reasonable question. One of the problems we have in cancer in general, and ovarian cancer is no different, is that if you look at the large trials that are out there that tell us what our standard of care should be, there's very few patients over age 70 on those trials. And in GOG is no different than the breast trial literature or the colon trial literature, and that is only about 10% of the patients are over age 70. So it makes it difficult because we know that probably 40% of ovarian cancer patients are over age 70. So we seem to have this trial system which has allowed us to determine how to treat relatively healthy cancer patients. And now we've got some cancer patients who are older, maybe have some comorbidities that may not tolerate things as well. And we've actually done some research on that here at the University of Oklahoma, and we've presented this at ASCO as well as SGO. And what we have found is that patients over age 80 really struggle with what we would consider standard therapy, whether it's standard debulking surgery or standard chemotherapy afterwards. And the number of patients who were able to get six cycles of traditional Taxol carboplatinum chemotherapy is actually quite low. Based upon this, the Gynecologic Oncology Group Ovarian Committee has approved a concept for development looking at elderly patients, patients over age 75, and creating a registry for these patients and starting some pharmacokinetic studies to see if we need to manage these patients differently than we do our younger patients.
Yeah, I like the fact in your papers you talk about the oldest old.
Right.
And actually, you know, an oncologist, they're really interested. I hear a lot of questions about people in their 80s, even in their 90s.
Right.
You know, sometimes you see people come in and they're great condition, very functional. In terms of intraperitoneal therapy specifically, is there an age limit in your own mind?
We don't have an age limit, though based upon, I think, reflection and looking at our own data, what we have recognized is that the standard tools that we use, such as performance status, such as blood tests, etc., do not seem to be overly accurate in predicting who's going to tolerate therapy once they get into the age range of 80 plus. One of the things we're looking for with the GOG trial is a new tool, whether that's activities of daily living tool, also pharmacokinetic tools, to see if we can better predict what patients can tolerate these more aggressive therapies. So in our own institution, we don't have a set cut point. However, we've certainly, in patients over age 80, are much more cautious than we probably were previously.
So getting back to the issue of bevacizumab, we're talking about bevacizumab in so many different tumor education programs, but where it seems like there's interesting data on Bev having an impact without chemo is ovarian cancer, also renal cell. What do you think it is about the biology of ovarian cancer that you see these responses to Bev alone?
If you look at controlling ascites, there's a fair amount of literature supporting that these vascular endothelial growth factor inhibitors actually are very good at controlling ascites. So I think it has to do more maybe with the cytokine milieu that exists in ovarian cancer being different than other cancers, and that this particular pathway is probably doing something against the tumor itself and its cytokine release, not just the growing of the blood vessels into the cancer. So I think it alludes back to what we talked about earlier. I think that bevacizumab and other VEGF inhibitors probably act at a variety of different levels, And maybe in an ovarian cancer, it has a greater impact because of the cytokine matrix that it's producing.
I guess the other thing I've heard is it seems like there are cases where maybe bevacizumab is actually having some kind of vascular anti-ascites effect that's maybe separate than an anti-tumor effect. And you hear about these patients who maybe they technically are progressing and yet have control of ascites. Have you had any patients like that?
Sure. And we know that ascites from ovarian cancer may not be directly the tumor, but it may be, once again, a cytokine mediated. In obstetrics and gynecology, there are tumors, we call them actually Meg syndrome. These are tumors that are benign tumors, they're just in the ovary, and they are associated with extensive ascites and pleural effusions, not because of any metastatic disease, but because of some sort of cytokine mediated release. And I think that you're probably seeing that with a lot of ovarian cancers. It's not necessarily the tumor itself, which is permeable, but it's the cytokines that the tumor's releasing that's causing the peritoneal membrane in the vessels to be permeable.
Now, I'm not sure exactly how easy or difficult it is to access bevacizumab right now in a non-protocol setting. Maybe it's geographically variable, I don't know. But what is the role, in your mind, theoretically, of bevacizumab right now outside of a trial setting?
Well, it is very dependent upon geographic location, I will tell you that. Even Medicare carriers in different regions have different rules, much less private insurance companies. By and large, I don't think the evidence is there for clinicians to utilize bevacizumab in an upfront setting. I think that should only be done on a research trial. With regards to recurrent disease, I think there is enough phase two evidence to indicate that it is a reasonable option. The caveats are, and certainly this is true with the GOG. GOG has not only the upfront trial, but it also has a recurrent trial, GOG 213, which is looking at bevacizumab with Taxol and carboplatinum. The eligibility criteria exclude patients who have evidence of bowel obstruction. So I think the caveat is if you are going to use it in a patient with ovarian cancer, it should not be in a patient that has evidence of bowel obstruction.
Is that just the phase two trial, or there's a randomization there?
There's a randomization. The randomization is between Taxol carbo alone versus Taxol carbo plus Bev. The second caveat is it appears that the further number of recurrences you've had, there's some concern that may increase your likelihood of perforation. So, though I have to tell you the data on that's fairly small, but that is a concern. So that at the current time, the GOG has limited the bevacizumab use to the frontline trial, the platinum-sensitive recurrent trial, and then sometimes a single-agent third-line trial.
Again, outside of a protocol setting, how do you generally approach or sort of what are your algorithm or algorithms for selection of agents in a sequential manner?
So I think that from a cytotoxic standpoint, what we basically look at is you're talking about in a recurrent setting.
Right.
All right. So the main dividing point is it platinum resistant or platinum sensitive? We would like to think things are black and white, but things aren't. I think the most clear is if somebody has platinum refractory disease or resistant disease less than 6 months, then those patients really do not do well with anything you give them. And so those patients can receive a variety of drugs. They can receive topotecan, Doxil, Gemzar, docetaxel. There are a number of FDA-approved drugs. I would say, however, that the likelihood of them doing well for very long is not great, and those patients should really be offered clinical trials. From the standpoint of who is the most sensitive to retreatment, it's not the six-month cutoff. It's actually the further you go from whenever you received your initial therapy, the greater the chances you're going to respond to retreatment with a platinum agent. So the most sensitive patients are greater than 24 months. And then you kind of have a zone which is pretty sensitive, 12 to 24 months. And then you have a zone which we still call sensitive, 6 to 12 months. But they're only really sensitive when you compare them to less than 6 months because they don't do well for very long. So in general, then, We divide patients up into platinum resistant, less than 6 months. We really try to get those patients on some form of clinical trial. If not, then I would suggest that most people in this country use Doxil. However, those other agents I mentioned, topotecan, Gemzar, docetaxel, et cetera, are reasonable agents as well. Greater than 6 months, 6 to 12 months, we consider an intermediate sensitivity category, and we actually, in the GOG, divide our clinical trials into a less than 6 to 12, and greater than 12 months. Those patients, most people feel that you can treat with an experimental regimen that does not include platinum and still be ethical with that. Off of any type of research trial, I would probably treat them back on a platinum-containing regimen. And then greater than 12 months, a platinum-containing regimen is preferable. ICON trial indicated that platinum Taxol is preferable to platinum alone. So most patients are retreated with their first recurrence greater than 12 months with a platinum taxane combination.
You mentioned the usual list of considerations in terms of liposomal doxorubicin, GEM, et cetera. Can you go through each one of these and talk a little bit about the kind of patient that is most suited for each and any clinical pearls about utilization of those agents?
So I think the big thing that we have to do as clinicians is when we're treating an ovarian cancer patient up front, our goal is a cure. And that goal is a very realistic goal. Now, that cure is going to come because we are willing to really work hard. We're going to do the right surgery, and that surgery may be long and tedious and carry some complications with it. But we know that if we can get to no residual disease, we've done the right thing for that patient. And then we're going to follow that with a fairly aggressive chemotherapy regimen. Almost always going to be combination, usually a platinum and taxane combination, and or management with a clinical trial. Now, one of the things we haven't talked about is maintenance therapy, and I can come back and address that if you'd like.
Sure.
But the goal, once again, of that particular regimen is cure. So we're willing to accept some neurotoxicity, some operative morbidity, et cetera. Once a patient's recurred, to date, we don't have a regimen which has a reasonable outcome of being a cure. So what we're really looking for is prolongation of progression-free survival. And how much progression-free survival can I buy at what cost? And that cost is the toxicity of the drug. So that when we look at it at our institution, off of clinical research trials in a recurrent patient, we're always balancing between toxicity and duration of progression-free survival. I will tell you, in the United States, probably the first-line drug is liposomal doxorubicin in this, and I think it's because of that. I mean, I think you can give a drug once a month, fairly non-toxic. Patients tolerate it well. Alopecia is not an issue. If they start having some palmar rash, you can reduce a level to 30 milligrams per meter squared. And the patients do well with that for a long period of time. And what's also interesting, as opposed to doxorubicin itself, there doesn't appear to be the cardiotoxicity. So these patients can continue on the liposomal doxorubicin until progression, which I've had patients on for 16, 18 treatment cycles, up to a couple of years, and do just great with it. So I would say that that's probably our first-line choice. The other drugs, some of the scheduling is a little more difficult. Topotecan, given weekly, is a possibility, or daily for 5 days. I know not every patient's the same, but for us, we have a large rural population, and driving's an issue. So having a daily infusion times five is a little more difficult for our population. But certainly, there's plenty of studies which indicate topotecan's a reasonable alternative. Nice thing about topotecan is, once again, it doesn't seem to have a cap on it. You can kind of keep giving it. As long as they're tolerating it and their disease is held at bay, you can continue topotecan for quite a while. And if you look at the response rate to topotecan, it's not that impressive. However, if you look at the six-month progression-free interval, it's actually fairly decent. It's one of our better drugs. So I think that's why clinically we see it to be reasonable. Even if the tumor's not shrinking, it's not growing, the patient's tolerating the therapy well, and we can press on. And then likewise with Gemzar, I think the Gemzar on a weekly basis is a very tolerable drug. Most patients don't have a lot of problems with that and can be given for a prolonged period of time. I think the issue that sometimes patients fall into or physicians is they try to do combination therapy as a third or fourth line regimen, and the patients don't tolerate that very well. And I think off of clinical trials, I think to do combination therapy in a third, fourth, fifth line setting is very difficult to do.
You are going to comment on the maintenance.
So maintenance therapy is another area of controversy. I've been involved in a lot of pro-con debates in my life. One of those is intraperitoneal therapy, and another is maintenance therapy. These seem to be areas that a lot of clinicians are conflicted on. They look at the data, and they are not real sure what to do. And maintenance therapy has been tried in other disease sites, as you know, and in other disease sites, there's some conflicting data as well. So in ovarian cancer, the largest trial was an intergroup trial between SWOG and GOG. The GOG number is GOG-178. That particular trial randomized between 3 months of Taxol given monthly at 175 milligrams per meter squared versus 12 months of Taxol given monthly at 175 milligrams per meter squared. And it compared progression-free survival. That was the endpoint. And what happened with that trial is, as you may expect, the progression-free survival was actually quite improved with the 12-month regimen. But we also gave 9 more months of Taxol therapy. And when we looked at overall survival, there wasn't any difference. The trial was designed with an early stopping rule based upon progression-free survival. So it was stopped after only accruing 262 patients. So its power to look at more subtle changes in survival isn't really there. So the community decided that it didn't know what to do. Do you offer maintenance therapy or not? The Gynecologic Cancer Intergroup Consensus Conference in 2005 reviewed maintenance therapy and based upon GOG-178 and did not feel it should be considered the standard of care for future clinical research trials, that it was still an open question. So based upon that, the GOG opened its own maintenance trial of GOG-212, which is patients who have advanced disease who are in a complete remission after frontline therapy to randomize to either no further therapy versus 12 months of monthly Taxol at 35 milligrams per meter squared versus a pegylated Taxol product called Zyotac at 135 milligrams per meter squared monthly for 12 months. That trial has met about 50% of its accrual goal.